Hi, my name's Tom. Thanks for coming out this afternoon to hear this talk. This talk is about the border search exemption to the Fourth Amendment's probable cause requirement. This has been a topical issue in the past few months, and I'll explain why it has suddenly become something that a lot of people are talking about. The simple sort of executive summary is that U.S. Customs is randomly searching the contents of electronic devices at border checkpoints, laptops, cell phones, PDAs, digital cameras. You may be asked to reveal your encryption key. Sometimes items are seized and they're returned without explanation weeks or months later. The Association of Corporate Travel Executives, which is a lobbying group that lobbies for the interests of business travelers, surveyed their members, and they had 100 members respond to their survey. And of those 100 members, seven reported having electronics seized at the border. On the customs website, it says everyone is subject to an inspection when they arrive in the U.S. There was a Senate hearing about this a few months ago, at which Peter Swire, who's an attorney at the Center for American Progress, said this issue may mobilize the reserve army of outraged techies. So I was randomly searched at the U.S. border once. I was flying into the U.S. from Australia, and I flew into LAX, and there were some guys out there that flagged me and my sister. I'm pretty sure that we were randomly selected because after they flagged us over, they kind of said, well, I think we've got enough, you know, as if they had some sort of quota they were meeting, and by selecting us, they'd reach that quota. They went through my bag. This was about 10 years ago. And, of course, they go through the bag, and for every sock and piece of underwear or whatever you have in your bag, they hold it up and they say, is this yours? Is this yours? Is this yours? So, you know, after about 20 or 30 items, you kind of get lulled into this sense of security, and you simply say yes without really paying attention to what it is they've held up in front of you. And this puts them in a position where they could hold up a bag of weed that they grabbed from under the table, and maybe you wouldn't notice before you'd already admitted that it was yours. So I came away from this experience a little frustrated. I was frustrated that I'm a U.S. citizen and I'm on U.S. soil and I was randomly searched by U.S. law enforcement. And I was also frustrated by the way that they asked the questions and the way that they searched me. It seemed like it was sort of designed to entice me to make a false confession. So in any event, I went home and did some research. And the first thing that I learned, number one item on their frequently asked questions list at that time was, why did you seize my Beanie Babies? Beanie Babies were quite popular about 10 years ago, and there was no internationally licensed distributor for them. So people would go overseas, and they would find Beanie Babies, and they would buy them, bring them back into the States. They would be randomly selected for search, and the Customs Department would seize their Beanie Babies. And so I want to keep this in mind. You know, Customs does have a very important role to play in fighting terrorism and narcotics trafficking, but a large majority of what they do is trade protectionism and intellectual property defense, and it's important to keep that in mind when you're weighing the importance of some of these rules against your civil liberties. So the other thing I learned is that the Fourth Amendment doesn't quite work the way that I thought that it did. This is the Fourth Amendment. The right of people to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So it turns out that the Fourth Amendment is read by lawyers as two different clauses. The first clause says that the right of the people to be secure against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. And the second clause says if you want to get a warrant, you have to establish probable cause. But there's no part of this thing that says when you have to get a warrant or that a warrant is required for a search to be reasonable. So my assumption that a warrant is always required is not true. And there are a number of contexts where a warrant is not required. The border is a context where no warrant is required. The U.S. Supreme Court said in 1977, searches made at the border are reasonable simply by virtue of the fact that they occur at the border. So no unreasonable searches, but any search we perform in this place is by definition reasonable. So, they are upholding the Fourth Amendment, but it doesn't provide you with much. Another case in 1985, routine searches of persons and effects of entrance are not subject to any requirement of reasonable suspicion, probable cause, or warrant. So they use this term reasonable suspicion. And this was actually very important in this 1985 case, so I'll talk about it. Routine searches can be performed at random at the border with no individualized suspicion. However, a search that's non-routine requires some sort of reasonable suspicion. They can't do it at random. So the question, what does that mean? What is a non-routine search and what is a routine search? There are two court cases, and we'll talk about them both, that kind of are closing in on a definition of what the line is. There's this lawsuit from 1985 where they said a search of a traveler's alimentary canal is a non-routine search. And so they have to have probable cause in order to handcuff you to a hospital bed for 3 days, hoping that you'll eject cocaine-filled balloons. On the other hand, there was a case from 2004 where they took someone's gas tank off their car and disassembled it, and that was viewed as a routine search. So on the one hand, we got gas tanks, and on the other hand, we have alimentary canals. And there's a lot of – the argument is about where the line is between those two things. So here's the other thing is, what is reasonable suspicion? It's not probable cause. Probable cause is a pretty high bar. Reasonable suspicion is a very low bar. Here's an example of a court case. This suspect arrived from Colombia. She was traveling alone. She had only one suitcase and nothing to declare. She was young, clean looking, and attractive, and she was wearing a loose fitting dress. That was reasonable suspicion. They searched her. Turned out she had some cocaine taped to her abdomen. And it was upheld. So a very, very loose standard. Here's some examples of reasonable suspicion. Suspect was first to the plane. Suspect was last to the plane. Suspect the plane from the middle. Suspect had one-way tickets. Suspect had round-trip tickets. Suspect was on a nonstop flight. Suspect changed planes. Suspect was traveling alone. Suspect was traveling with a companion. Suspect acted nervously. Suspect acted too calmly. So pretty much reasonable suspicion means whatever the hell they want it to mean. And mind you, if they can establish reasonable suspicion when you come into the country, they can handcuff you to a bed for 3 days. The key legal question that's going on right now is, do laptop searches require reasonable suspicion? I'm going to read this slide backwards. The first question is, reasonable suspicion is such a weak standard. Well, who cares? There's two important differences. If reasonable suspicion is required to search a laptop, then they can't do it at random. They can only do it when they have some reason to do it. They have to come up with a reason. They have to care. The other thing is, they can't do it to everybody. If reasonable suspicion is not required, then let's imagine hard drive duplication technology improved tremendously and it was possible to image someone's hard drive very quickly. Then it would be economically feasible for them to bring everyone through and just have them set their laptop down and they'll zap, we'll get a copy of it, put it in our database, and you go on your way. Under the law that as the Customs Service is arguing it should be, that would be perfectly legal. They could do it to everyone coming in the country. So that's something we need to keep in mind, and we need to think long term into the future about what the implications of this policy are when we decide what side we want to take in this debate. There's this case from 2004, the gas tank case, and I talked about it earlier, and I said, is a search of a laptop more like searching a gas tank or more like searching an alimentary canal? Some people think, if you got to take someone's clothes off, then it's definitely a violation of their privacy that's different from a normal search. And so we'll put that over here. But a laptop is just like any other piece of luggage. And so it's a physical object, it's property. And so it doesn't require reasonable suspicion. That's where some people draw the line. In my view, you don't have a lot of personal privacy interest in your gas tank. I don't know about you, but my gas tank has gas in it. So the idea that the cops are looking into it, I honestly don't like the idea that that's considered a routine search, but it's really not like a huge problem. However, if you go through my laptop, I've got all my personal correspondence in there. I've got all my, all my writings. I've got software archives going. I've got personal work archive going back years. All kinds of really personal, intimate stuff. I got pictures of my family and friends from vacations. These are not things that I obviously am more protective of the contents of my laptop than I am over the contents of my gas tank. And so I think there is a difference. Before I get into, there's actually a lawsuit that's where this issue is being litigated. But before I get into it, I ask whether this whole legal framework about reasonable suspicion even makes sense. In 1985, that was the first time they said routine searches do not require any reasonable suspicion. And they justified it with this footnote. And they said, see this case from 1977 called U.S. versus Ramsey. So you go back and you look at this case, U.S. versus Ramsey, and it quotes, it says, the Congress which proposed the Bill of Rights, including the Fourth Amendment, to the state legislatures in 1789 had, some 2 months prior to that proposal, enacted the first customs statute. This statute granted customs officials full power and authority to enter and search any ship or vessel in which they have reason to suspect any goods, wares, or merchandise are subject to duty shall be concealed. And so the court says, you know, well, because in 1789, the guys that passed the Fourth Amendment felt that the customs service should be able to search people without a warrant, you know, it's okay for them to search people without a warrant. But it seems clear to me that the first Congress felt that the customs service should have reason to suspect that the things that they were searching contained some contraband, and this is not an authorization to search at random. However, in 1985, the Supreme Court said, it's okay to search at random, and this is why. And I don't buy that. That doesn't follow for me. However, there's this lawsuit, U.S. versus Arnold, which is currently going on. On July 17th, 2005, this guy Michael Arnold arrived at LAX. He was selected for secondary screening. He said he was visiting friends in the Philippines. He had a computer. They booted it up. They started looking at it. He had two folders. One's Kodak pictures, and the other one's Kodak memories. The agents clicked on the pictures, and they found a picture that depicted two nude women. Now, there's actually a footnote in this ruling that says that Customs hasn't established that those two nude women were not adult women. So, as far as anyone knows, this was just porn. In any event, they called over the Customs Service. The Customs Service went over through the laptop, and eventually they found child pornography. So, and again, it's important to understand that, you know, for every one of these really bad guys that gets picked up, there's a bunch of other people who've been searched, but they don't get to go to court because they're never charged with anything. It's only the guys who are really bad who end up in front of a judge, and then you have an opportunity to litigate whether or not the search that was performed against them is reasonable. And so, unfortunately, when you're trying to defend people's civil liberties, you sometimes have to take the side of really bad guys. And this guy is not necessarily a good guy. You know, we don't like him in general, but, you know, the fact is that he was in a position where he was subject to a random search without any establishment of reasonable suspicion. And so, the question is, it was that right, irrespective of who he is and whether or not he ought to be prosecuted in general. So there was a ruling in 2006, which I was very optimistic about, from the Ninth Circuit Court, which says that this gas tank case acknowledged that there were cases where significant privacy interests were at hand, and it simply said the gas tank isn't one of those cases. But the laptop, they said, is one of those cases, and so reasonable suspicion is required to search a laptop. And I was very optimistic about that. However, and this is why this has become an issue right now, in April of 2008, the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court came down with an opposite ruling. Essentially, they overturned the district court. They said that we used to have this privacy intrusiveness analysis for border searches, but because of Flores Montano, this gas tank case, we can no longer do that, and therefore, you know, reasonable suspicion is not needed to search laptops. There's a couple reasons why I don't like this Ninth Circuit ruling. It is currently the binding ruling. The first is that this gas tank case was specifically about vehicles. They say, complex balancing tests to determine what is a routine search and an intrusive search have no place in border searches of vehicles. But they leave open the question of whether there are other contexts where it might make sense to have an intrusiveness analysis. And this court just sort of glosses over that fact and acts as if it generally applies to property. And you see that same sleight of hand in Wikipedia, where they actually replace the word vehicle with the word property as if they were synonymous in their summary of this in Wikipedia. The other thing is, so in the gas tank case, they said if the search is particularly offensive, then maybe we'll require reasonable suspicion. And the court attempted to describe why it wasn't particularly offensive. And the way that they reached this conclusion is very convoluted, and it's difficult to understand. So I apologize in advance, but I'm going to try to explain it to you. Basically, a warrant is not required to search a car. The reason is that a car can drive to a different jurisdiction, and it takes time to get a warrant. You have to call the judge and go through this whole process. And while you're doing that, a car could leave wherever it is and go somewhere else where you don't have jurisdiction to search it anymore. So you don't have to get a warrant. The police don't have to get a warrant to search a car, but they do have to establish probable cause, which is the same standard of suspicion that they would need to establish if they were going to get a warrant. It's just that the warrant process, the bureaucratic process, isn't there. So there was this guy who was selling pot out of his mobile home, and the cops searched it. They established probable cause, but they didn't have a warrant. And he went into court, and he said, they should have gotten a warrant. It's my house that they searched, irrespective of the fact that it's a vehicle. And the court held that, no, it's a vehicle, and for the same reason that they don't need a warrant to search a car, they don't need a warrant to search a mobile home. The fact that it's also your home is irrelevant. What's important is that it can move from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So in this laptop case, the Ninth Circuit relied on that rationale to argue that you know, laptops are readily mobile, and you know, because of that, they no reasonable suspicion is required, and it's hard to even sort of explain how they related these two things together. In my view, there's a difference between the concept of the standard of suspicion and the bureaucratic process required to prove that you reach that standard of suspicion. So the fact that there's no warrant requirement for a vehicle, well, there, we can understand that, but at the same time, you still have the same standard of suspicion. They still have to establish probable cause. At the border, a reasonable suspicion is a standard of suspicion. Establishing it doesn't introduce any delay. And so this whole concept of laptops being mobile, you know, is completely irrelevant because there's no bureaucratic process they have to go to. If they look at you and they say, I have reason to suspect you're a crook, you look like a crook, and here I've got some reasons that I think you're crooked, that's enough. So in my view, this is extremely sloppy, and I'm sorry if that was unclear. The reason it's unclear is because it's a really sloppy decision, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Currently, that's the law. And so a lot of people are reacting to this decision because it has huge implications, because it was a sloppy decision, and because there's a chance that it could be upheld. The other thing that happened shortly after this decision was handed down was the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which was leaked on May 22nd. It's really unclear what's happening here. It's a bunch of countries getting together, but what they're talking about, I'll read you this quote from Canada.com. They said, the deal would create an international regulator that could turn border guards and other public security personnel into copyright police. Security officials would be charged with checking laptops, iPods, and even cellular phones for content that infringes on copyright laws, such as ripped CDs or movies. The guards would also be responsible for determining what is infringing content and what is not. So that's the other shoe, right? I mean, most of y'all probably don't have kiddie porn on your laptop, but you might have a few MP3s. Now, my view is that if they take your iPod, they can't tell whether or not the contents of your iPod are legally obtained or not. But if you have like BearShare on your laptop or something like that, and you've got like a incoming and outgoing directory, and you got a bunch of stuff in there, you know, that's probably prosecutable. And you know, we're looking at a real situation where customs agents could begin searching people's laptops specifically looking for that, just as they used to look for Beanie Babies. It's not just serious stuff they look for. Sometimes they do look for intellectual property stuff. So what has happened? This case will be appealed to the Supreme Court. The people who like this status quo have argued that it's possible that that appeal will be denied. We'll see what happens. Hopefully, one of the reasons that so many people who are concerned about this are making a lot of noise right now is so that the Supreme Court knows that people are watching, and hopefully that will make it more likely for them to take the case. The Washington Post has reported that law firms are asking employees who travel to keep two laptops. One laptop for use at home and another laptop for travel. In some jobs, that's actually fairly reasonable, even regardless of U.S. policy. If you're going to go to China, it's possible that the Chinese government could search your laptop. So you might not want to take all your trade secrets with you. There's some real concern about that, but that concern is growing because of our searches. And the problem is when we go to China and we say, really, we're worried about the fact that you're searching laptops, we'd rather you didn't do it. They're going to have a hard time making that argument because we're searching laptops too. We're searching Chinese people's laptops. So, you know, quid pro quo. It's a real problem. Jennifer Granick, who some of you may know, she's an attorney at the EFF. She posted some advice for travelers. I'll talk about that a little bit more later. Also, the EFF wrote an open letter to Congress, and they said, have hearings on this. And they also filed an FOIA lawsuit in order to learn more about border search practices. So it turns out that Congress listened to the EFF, and they actually held a hearing. The Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing on June 20th, 2008, so that's a big win. And you can go read some of the testimony, and you've got testimony from all sides of the spectrum on this, except for from the Customs Service itself, which is kind of frustrating. There was a editorial on July 10th from the New York Times who said, you know, this is bullshit, don't do this. There was an editorial. So Michael Chertoff, who is, I think, the DHS director, wrote an editorial in the USA Today on July 16th, kind of responding to the New York Times editorial. In that editorial, he says, travelers only go to secondary when there's some level of suspicion. Legislation locking in a particular standard for searches would have dangerous, chilling effect, as officers often have to make split-second assessments and are second-guessed. So what he's saying is that they do employ reasonable suspicion, but they don't want it to be the law because then, you know, their judgment might be second-guessed. So I'm going to get back to that Michael Chertoff quote in a minute because that became a matter of some controversy. And in any event, I actually spoke on the subject at Hackers on Planet Earth in New York City on July 20th. And there I was the first person to publicly announce this thing called Hands Off My Laptop, which is run by the Center for American Progress, which is a Democratic think tank in Washington, D.C. There's actually someone here at the con from CAP, but I don't think he's in the room right now. In any event, the number of people who responded to that thing because of me was probably pretty small, but CAP has a very large network, and so there were thousands of people who signed up on this website. It's essentially a petition. It goes to DHS, and it asks DHS to do a privacy impact study of their policy to see how many people's laptops are searched, how many people's laptops are seized, and how many prosecutions does this net. So anyway, I think that was a successful campaign, and that campaign's still ongoing, but 2 weeks later, DHS published their laptop search policies. So that's kind of a success. They're at least becoming more open about what it is that they're doing. So let's talk about what these policies consist of. First of all, they say, notwithstanding this law enforcement mission, and this is one of the first things they say, in the course of every border search, we'll protect the rights of individuals against unreasonable search and seizure. Thank you very much. As far as I know, there is no imaginable search or seizure which is not authorized by this policy in this context, so that's a little silly. But in any event, in the course of a border search, absent in any individualized suspicion, they can review and analyze the information transported by any individual. Officers may detain documents and electronic devices or copies thereof for a reasonable period of time. So, you know, essentially what we knew has now been admitted to by the Customs Service, that they will look at anything that you bring in and they can seize it without individualized suspicion. Except as noted, now this is important, except as noted in the section, if after reviewing information there exists no probable cause to seize it, they will not retain it. I'm not sure that, they do destroy the data if they decide that they have no reason to prosecute you. If the alternative to destroying the data is keeping it, and keeping it would require an infrastructure for keeping it, and so that would cost money. So it may simply be the case that they've decided that they don't want to spend money keeping the data, and not the case that they're destroying it because they want to be nice to your privacy. In any event, there are three classes of information they spelled out as being special. One is business information. They'll treat business information as confidential, and they'll take all reasonable measures to protect that information from unauthorized disclosure. I would hope that they would also take all measures to protect non-business information from unauthorized disclosure, but be that as it may, there are actually things like the Trade Secrets Act that they could be held liable on if for some reason they obtained business information, of course, somebody searches and disclosed it, so that's why that's there. They don't open letters. in the mail, which is not really, it's a little outside the context of this question, but they spelled out that if a letter is in the mail, they won't open a letter. They may open a package in the mail, but not a letter. And by the way, DHL, UPS, and Federal Express are not the mail. And furthermore, having a letter that's sealed in your luggage is not the mail. It actually has to be in the mail. The other thing they mentioned is attorney-client privilege material, and it's kind of clear, the wording is a little weaselly, but it's kind of clear that basically they're concerned about a situation where they're prosecuting somebody, and the opposing attorney ends up getting randomly selected for search, and he's got the information about the case on the laptop, because if their agent obtains that information, then that could undermine their lawsuit. So, what they say is if it smells like that, then they need to talk to the chief counsel or the U.S. attorney's office. So, essentially, these things are to protect the customer service. They're not to protect you. The second sealed class letter mail issue is related to a federal law. Again, any search is essentially authorized. The one good thing is that they're not retaining the data after they're done looking at it. A week after this information was published, Chertoff did an interview with Wired magazine. Wired said, "Wouldn't it allay the suspicions of the business community if you had a policy that says we only search through laptops if we have a good reason to do so?" And Chertoff says, "That's exactly why I put it on the internet. It's on the web to say we only do it when we put you in secondary. We only put you in secondary when there is a suspicion, when there is a reason to suspect someone." He uses these words, reason to suspect. Well, you just saw the words from the policy. I'm going the wrong way. Yeah, you just saw the words from the policy, which I pasted in this morning, or actually yesterday. It says, absent individualized suspicion, officers can review and analyze the information. It doesn't say when we have a reason to. It says whenever we want. And so Senator Russ Feingold, who's from Wisconsin, called him out on that, and he says, "Secretary Chertoff's blatant mischaracterization of the DHS policy contradicts his claim to be engaging in greater openness on this important issue. His statements make it clearer than ever that we must work to protect our, as we work to protect our national security, Congress must also act to protect law-abiding Americans against highly intrusive searches. Feingold wants to make it illegal for them to search your laptop without reasonable suspicion." And he did catch Chertoff at least being misinformed, if not being dishonest. So Wired went back to DHS, and they got this guy named Russ Nock, and he says, "Oh, well, this is just sour grapes and paranoia from someone who can't accept that even the Ninth Circuit ruled that what we're doing is constitutional." So that Ninth Circuit ruling he's referring to is the one that I tried very hard to explain to you before that was completely nonsensical. So when they start referencing that Ninth Circuit decision, I don't take them very seriously because that decision is very sloppy. The WAPO on August 13th, this is the last thing that I know that has happened around this issue. They published an editorial on August 13th, and they kind of subtly acknowledged this exchange between Chertoff and Feingold. And then they said, even though DHS says that they only do it when they have reason to suspect something, that should be written into law. So you now have both the New York Times and the Washington Post saying that this should be written into law. I'd say that there's a consensus forming there, although, perhaps both of those could be accused of being liberal media. I don't know if someone's going to take the opposing view in the room. In any event, that's where things stand today with respect to this issue. I hope that the Supreme Court does pick this up and analyze it. Possibly going to be some congressional action, but it's a developing situation, and it's important. I'm glad that you're all here because it's important that people are aware of the situation. It's important that people are, if they're concerned about it, are communicating with their legislators about it right now because this is when decisions are being made. So what can you do to protect yourself from a random search? Everyone always asks this question. A bunch of people have written about this on the internet. A lot of people say, well, you should encrypt all your data. The question is whether the customs agents can force you to turn over your password. Granick says that one federal court ruled that you have a Fifth Amendment right to refuse to reveal your password. You have a right to not incriminate yourself. And so if they ask you to give your password, you can say, "I plead the Fifth." It's an interesting argument. Unfortunately, it's controversial. Orrin Kerr, who's a law professor at George Washington University, says, "The password itself is not incriminating, only the information it protects, and therefore you have no Fifth Amendment right to refuse to reveal the password. They can throw you in jail if you refuse to reveal the password, because the password cannot be incriminating in and of itself." I think that's a bunch of bullshit, but in any event, that question is going to continue to be litigated in the courts over the next few years, and it is undecided. I got a question in the back. I guess I'll take it.
Speaking to that, I mean, the counter argument would be if they would come to a point for your house, you have a file cabinet full of papers that are incriminating, you can't invoke the Fifth Amendment on something you've written down. It's only against what you speak, correct?
I don't know. That's an interesting. Yeah, I mean, you can't. If they have a warrant to search your file cabinet, they have access to your file cabinet. You can't say, I'm not going to let you read it because I'm pleading the Fifth, right? They can look at it if they have a warrant. But the question is, what if there's a combination lock on the file cabinet and they need the combination from you?
They could break it,
right? But if they can't break it, let's say it's like the ultimate safe and there's no way in. All right. Can they force you to tell them what the password is? It's an interesting question. It hasn't been fully litigated. I think that they can't, but I don't know as much about the laws or in care, so it's controversial.
The distinction I make is that they don't have a warrant for your laptop.
No, in this case, they don't have a warrant for your laptop. That's true, but it's also a different context where they decided that the search is reasonable in spite of the fact that they don't have a warrant because you're at the border.
The problem with border law is when you're coming into the country, you're applying entrance back into the country. And so you're kind of in a no man's land. You might be physically in the country, but you're applying for admission. And until customs grants you admission into the country, you don't have a lot of the rights that you normally have. Like, we don't have to have a warrant. We don't, I'm saying we because I'm a customs officer.
Now you're in the hot seat.
I'm mostly here to help you.
Okay.
So you say, well, I think that I want you don't have that right. That's
well,
I'm not gonna like beat you down and like put stuff on it. You do have obvious rights, but there are a lot of rights.
That's an interesting question, too, and I don't know. Like, everything that I've read, the argument has been that that you do have a Fourth Amendment right. It's just that all searches are reasonable. And so as opposed to saying that you don't have a Fourth Amendment right. So I'm interested in the question that you've just raised, which is, do you have a Fifth Amendment right? Maybe there are some amendments that don't apply and some that do.
You're
in a weird nether zone, and exactly what the rules are, is interesting. Oh, so there's a bunch of questions, and I kind of want to go on with the presentation, and I'm going to leave time to ask questions at the end. Is that cool?
Yeah.
All right. So, agents could detain you if you refuse to reveal your password. They could seize your laptop. They could deny you entry in the United States, theoretically. Tammy probably knows more about that than anyone else who's commented on this so far. What I've read is that they've said technically they could deny you entry in the U.S., but it's apparently very difficult to do that if you're a U.S. citizen, and no one's really sure what the rules are.
If you're a U.S. citizen, you can't deny you entry into your own country.
Yeah.
If you're an immigrant, they can revoke your status. But if you're a citizen, we can't deny you entry into your own country.
But they can't take your laptop.
Oh, yeah, they can totally take your laptop.
So there's this thing called TrueCrypt, and a bunch of people in the scene have been like, dude, run TrueCrypt. And TrueCrypt is this program that allows you to have a hidden drive on your computer. And you can also have a hidden operating system in their new release. I don't advise you to use this as a way of fooling the customs service. First of all, if you're running TrueCrypt, they have this thing called Travel Mode, right? Suspiciously named, which tries to make the thing totally invisible. The software itself is not visible on your computer. But the fact is that there's still a key in the registry. And the customs agents are not stupid, especially the ones doing computer analysis. They know how to do computer analysis. That's their job. They may know to check for this registry key, and they'll find your TrueCrypt. If you're running the dual OS, like hidden operating system, TrueCrypt mode, then there's a bootloader that is used to make that work, and they could detect the bootloader. If I was them, I would be looking for this stuff. So then you're in a difficult position. You can deny that there's a hidden OS, and they can detain you, hoping you'll fess up, and that's not fun. And it's possible that if you're super slick and you use some really sophisticated steganography and they're not too interested in you, that you could, have some data on your laptop that they don't see and you could slide by. But it's not something that I would advise that you try to do. And it's probably more difficult than you think. So there's this security researcher, and I'm not going to try to pronounce his last name because I can't. What? There you go. So go in. So he says, and I don't think this is very practical, but it's an interesting thought process because it helps you think about this policy. You can wipe your laptop, encrypt your data, and put it on a file server, or mail an encrypted DVD to the destination in a letter envelope, which they won't open. Then travel to your destination, download the data at the destination, decrypt it and use it, and then re-encrypt it and re-upload it to the internet or remail it, and then wipe your laptop again and travel again. And so that's not very practical. However, it goes to show you that in some respects, basically what's happened here is not a situation where someone sat down and they said, we need to start looking at information coming into the United States. How are we going to do that? Well, we need to look at it on this place, this place, this place. And one of those places was laptops coming in on the border. That's not what happened. What happened is that customs is used to searching stuff at the border, and people started bringing laptops, and so they started searching the laptops along with everything else. And it doesn't necessarily logically fit into like a holistic perspective about how you'd go about, you know, creating an information bubble around the United States. And this example kind of demonstrates that. So it's a useful thought process. So in my view, I don't think you should try to fool the customs agents, nor do I think you should lie to them. I think you should advocate that the policies change if you don't agree with the policies. This is America. And I have been advocating that these policies change for quite some time and very vocally. I was not selected for secondary screening. I came back into the country on Monday from Asia. You know, they're not targeting me. This is America, and we have a right to speak our mind. And, you know, and they're willing to have an honest debate about this, and they're trying to be open about it. DHS has published a number of blog entries on their blogs about it where you can comment. You know, they want to have a dialogue. So let's have a dialogue, and let's figure out what we think, and let's express our views, and let's get the policy right. And I don't think we should have to be afraid to fly overseas with our laptops. And I'll get really the last slide really talks about the nature of privacy. So I'll explain that observation at the end. These slides are from a HackerCon where I gave this talk, and there are a lot of people in the hacker scene who are like, dude, let's make tools that protect people from searches. And I don't really think that's a great idea. I don't like situations where you create this policy that forces everyone to act like they're a criminal and creates these tools that enable you to cover your tracks, because most people are not criminals. And those tools end up getting used by criminals. And so the problem is that you end up enabling people to hide. So a good example is Nutella, right? People are using Nutella to exchange MP3 files because we don't have a good way of dealing with intellectual property and music. And it never got sorted out right. And so you ended up with Napster before you had iTunes. And so as a result, you had this really bad thing where you developed this culture of people downloading music off the internet without paying for it. And that still persists today. And they have these tools that are designed so they can do it without getting in trouble. And it gets used by people who are interested in trading child pornography. And nobody who's involved with Nutella wants to enable that, but they do. And so it's a good idea to, instead of building these infrastructures that allow us to get away with crime, that we actually try to change the law so that it's reasonable instead, so that we don't end up enabling people to do bad things. And so that's my view of TrueCrypt and some of these other tools. That's not the right answer. I think that a lot of you use the internet probably, and you probably debate people on the internet. I'm going to arm you, I hope, with some arguments about this issue. And those arguments are useful for debating people on the internet. And debating people on the internet is actually important because it helps develop people's perception of an issue and what they think the right answer should be. The internet is how we figure things out today. So, I think that when the Fourth Amendment says no unreasonable searches, it means that you have to have a reason to search something. That seems pretty logical to me. It's an arguable point, but it seems pretty logical to me. A lot of people who advocate these searches say that there's this ancient right of the sovereign to search people at the border without reasonable suspicion. I don't think that that's true. The first case precedent that refers to reasonable suspicion is from 1985. And the original Congress in 1789 said that they must have reason to suspect the thing that they're searching contains contraband. And so I do not buy the idea that there's this ancient right to search randomly. And it may be the case, but it hasn't been proven. Furthermore, the Ninth Circuit said that they implied an intrusiveness analysis up until this case in 2004 with the gas tank. So this is new law. This is not old law. And there's still a chance that it might to discuss it. Random searches are not efficient. Customs has limited resources, and those resources should be targeted. People are in some way suspicious. There is a terrorist that they found at the border. They found a guy with a laptop, and he had videos of, like, martyrdom videos and instructions about how to build IEDs. But that guy was flagged using this system called ATS, which is this traveler profiling system. It's been controversial itself, but in any event, he wasn't, like, randomly selected. He was found because he fit the profile of a terrorist. The other thing is computers are not just like luggage. Luggage contains nothing by default, and you add only what you want to bring on the trip, whereas computers by default contain everything that you have. And if you want to remove something, you have to specifically go in and remove it. And that's a big difference. There are little sort of edge cases that might have been like that or equivalent to that in the past, but never before have people been bringing so much of their personal information with them all the time. That is totally new as of 5 years ago. And it's really a new situation, and it has to be thought of in a new light. And rationalizations from the drug war era are not necessarily directly applicable to it. John Perry Barlow famously said 15 years ago that you can have my encryption algorithm when you pry my cold, dead fingers from its private key. That's an attitude that people are going to have. And it's inevitable that Customs is going to ask someone for their password, and they're going to say no. Someone is going to be the Rosa Parks on this thing. And unlike Rosa Parks, who was able to carefully select the place at which she was arrested and had lawyers ready to go, the person who ends up being this guy will not have lawyers ready to go. And the lawyers who, may be interested in the subject for one reason or another might not be willing to help him. So I would not advise being this person if you happen to get searched. Eventually it's going to happen. Somebody is going to refuse to turn over their keys, and it's going to turn into an issue. And this goes back to Sheohygin's idea. People smuggle information over the internet, okay? They don't smuggle it in on laptops. It's just sort of incidental that someone might have legal information on their laptop. If they were really seriously interested in bringing bad stuff into the country, they'd be doing it online. And the internet links are protected by FISA. You have to have a warrant to search them. It's not even a question of reasonable suspicion. It's a question of probable cause. The latest update to FISA, which was passed just a few months ago, requires a warrant even when you're overseas if you're a U.S. citizen and they want to monitor your communications on the internet. So it's we have this totally different standard over here, and if it's okay for that standard to be that way over here, then it must be okay for it to be that way over here. Right now we have a very serious contradiction. If you care about this issue, even if you totally disagree with me, you think I'm an asshole and you think that these searches should totally be legal, one way or the other, you have a right to express your opinion to your congressperson, and you should. And don't be a jerk, even if they're jerks, because no one likes jerks. If you're writing members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, I would thank them for holding a hearing on the subject, if this is something you care about, and tell them that Customs, in my view, Customs should not be allowed to perform searches of laptops or electronics without reasonable suspicion. I don't think reasonable suspicion is a very high bar for them to meet. I don't think it will tie their hands, and I think it will prevent, random searches with quotas, and it will prevent searches of everyone. So I think that's important. And also ask Customs to perform a privacy impact assessment. Like, no one knows exactly how many people are being searched and what the impact of this is. So we need more information in order to make the right choices. There's this Hands Off My Laptop campaign that I mentioned before, and you can still go to this website and you can still register, and it sends message to DHS and it tells them that you want a privacy impact study and it's worth doing. This is my last slide, and then I'll open up for questions. There's this question that always comes up in this context, and it's like, why are you worried about this? Like, if you're not doing anything wrong, then you have nothing to hide. So, what is the issue with that? This is a difficult. When I originally presented this at Hope, someone actually argued with me about it. So I'll present those arguments first. Basically, the bottom line is that we're human, our laws, first of all, are not necessarily perfect. And that was one of the arguments made at Hope. Sometimes we have bad laws. Sometimes we have laws that are passed on the basis of sensationalism. People who really believe about this "you've got nothing to hide" argument, they don't buy into the idea that laws aren't questionable, or if they do. They think the right way to deal with that is through the legislature. Sometimes the police are not good guys. Usually they are, but sometimes they're crooked. And so, again, we're human, and so that's got to factor into it. But again, the people who make this "you've got nothing to hide" argument usually don't buy into the idea that the police could be corrupt, and or if they do, they think that internal affairs or some other way of dealing with it is the right way to deal with it. And so the real question is that in a society where you've got perfect laws and you've got perfect police, why should you be concerned about violations of your privacy if you're not a criminal? And so I try to think about this, and this is the best explanation I have for that, and that is that a criminal, somebody who knows they're up to no good, they live life looking over their shoulder. They're worried about getting busted, and they're thinking every time they do something, about whether or not it's going to end up exposing them, and they have to live their life that way, and that's the consequence of being a criminal. Innocent people, don't have to live that way, generally speaking. But if we put innocent people in a situation where they're constantly being forced to be scrutinized by the police, and anything that falls out of that scrutiny that is suspicious gets prosecuted, we put them in a position where they have to think the way a criminal thinks. They have to constantly consider every email they send, every file they put in their laptop, everything that they do with their computer. If I got searched at the border and somebody found this, would they misinterpret it? Could this be suspicious? Maybe I shouldn't have this on my computer. Maybe I should delete it, even if it's perfectly legal, because I just don't want to answer questions about it. And so people become, they self-censor. They have this sort of internal policeman who constrains their actions, and it actually diminishes their life. If you talk to people who lived in Eastern Europe, under the socialist regime there, talk about people who lived in East Germany, and the way they always had to look over their shoulder, the way they always had to worry about, what their neighbors were thinking about what they were doing and who might be reporting things to the Stasi. This is not something that we want to live with. And the Fourth Amendment helps us not live with that because it creates a barrier, and it says the police will investigate people that they have a reason to investigate, and everyone else that they're going to leave alone. And that's how you create a free society. That's what I think. So that's why I think this is important. So that's my presentation, and I'm sure that there are questions and there are probably comments. So thanks.
from the other side, I work in information security for Georgia Tech. One of the issues we're looking at right now is we send professors over to conferences in other countries, and we're having to deal with corporate and government-sponsored espionage on projects that may be under disclosure laws. So we have to worry about, hey, you go into China, they say, "Can we look at your laptop, please?" And it comes back with a Trojan on it. So when they bring it back to the office, it's actually sending out passwords and they're getting into our systems. That's becoming a real threat.
Mm-hmm.
So from one perspective, yeah, I want the hackers to come up with the tools that we can use to protect them.
There's some validity to that perspective that we get to control U.S. policy. We don't get to control the Chinese policy. I do believe that we're going to have trouble arguing that the Chinese shouldn't be searching laptops if we're doing it. But even if we do decide that we're not going to search laptops, the Chinese might still search laptops. It's something that we need to be concerned about anyway. And you're right, TrueCrypt. I don't want to rain on TrueCrypt. I don't think it's crap. It has legitimate purposes. I just don't think this is one of them.
Well, I agree with you that what we should really be attacking is the real problem, which is bad policy. You don't try to manipulate policy by coming up with a defensive technology. I totally agree with that. However, at the same time, I need that to defend myself against other people who play by no rules.
Yeah.
And I have no influence over their policy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, be advised that if I get your laptop, I'll find your TrueCrypt. And so far, no one has developed, and I don't think it's really we could have an intellectual conversation about this, maybe at Hacking 201 later tonight, about whether or not it's possible to architect something that is not discoverable, but everything that everyone has built so far, I can find.
Not once you tell anybody else about it.
Yeah, perhaps, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you could bake your own stenography, but then again, if you bake your own steganography, then you run the risk that you haven't been peer-reviewed, and so you might have made a stupid mistake.
Just speaking to the idea of developing tools for all this and everything, I mean, in the popular literature in corporate IT right now, companies that have mature VPN infrastructures already are telling their, not just law firms, they're telling all of their big companies are telling their employees, travel with a clean laptop, VPN into the office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, they do it for many reasons. This guy over here.
Okay, so your argument was basically, even if you did have some kind of program that was undetectable and all that, and all they could tell on your laptop was maybe you had a bunch of random data and that was kind of suspicious on there because there was no partitions or anything, it would still be unpleasant because they could put you in a back room and interrogate.
If they suspect that you're hiding or you're lying to them, then they can make your life uncomfortable, yeah.
What exactly, how far can they go with that? Or I'm more appropriate to address to the...
Can I answer it and then you answer it? But the worst case that I've heard of is the case from 1985 where that woman was, they suspected she had swallowed cocaine balloons. And so what they did is they threw her in an office. And they threw her in the office for, they basically gave her a garbage can to go to the bathroom in, and they left her in there for an entire day. They held her for 3 days, I think, all told. And eventually what happened is that she, did in fact swallow cocaine balloons. And so that push came to shove and they put her in jail. I don't know of a situation where, you know, they've tried to do that to someone and there was no evidence. And so they continue to push the button. You know, I think eventually at some point, you know, they're going to release you because they don't. Because there's nothing for them to continue to push you on, but I'm quite certain that they can't detain you without reasonable suspicion. If they're detaining you at that point, they've got at least some reason that they think you're shifty. It's not just because they did it at random. What do you think, Tammy?
Yeah, we don't. I've actually participated in a couple of people who swallow drugs, and we've taken you to the hospital for that now.
I'm sorry, that case was pretty egregious. I realize that's not usually what happens. I don't think that that's usually their policy. It was just a pretty bad case, and that's why it went to the Supreme Court. If you read the U.S. the customs policy on laptop searches, what they do say is that they're allowed to ask for interagency help on decryption. So if they looked at your laptop and they said, we don't understand it, then what they may do is seize it and send you on your way, and they hand it over to the NSA or somebody for analysis. And then, according to the policy, they can seize it without individualized suspicion. Now, Chertoff says that they actually won't do that, that they will only seize it if they have some reason to suspect you. He just doesn't want that to be a legal standard because then he's got to defend it in court. But then again, you know, are we a country of what Chertoff says, or are we a country of laws? But, and you know, this person.
So, how far are we away from business and government and whatever laptops where the hard drive just pops out, and either you put in one that's blank and is easily to boot up and easily go through and you mail the laptop, or conversely, you just take the whole laptop with you, you just take the hard drive with you, leave the laptop, get another one there, pop it in, and then...
Well, then they'll take your hard drive at the border and they'll put it in their laptop and they'll figure it out.
So how far are we away from just mailing the laptop that has anything interesting on it?
Well, they can open packages. They can open packages. They can't open letters. So.
Plain laptop is already a settled term that is normally used.
Yeah. I mean, corporations are deploying policies where they say you need to have a clean travel laptop, and that is in response to this policy as well as policies of other countries. I mean, there may be a market opportunity here to serve corporations that want a clean laptop policy and provide them with technology like you're talking about to make it easy for them to do so. It's interesting. That's another sort of technology versus policy question. If this becomes established and the Supreme Court decides that these searches are reasonable, and other countries, and we know that Canada does this. I don't know how many countries do this, but certainly I know that Canada does. If enough countries sign on to this and corporate IT starts reacting to it, then you could end up with a situation where there's a market for technology that serves it. I'm trying to figure out who is like the next person. Go ahead, because you had your hand up earlier.
I'm assuming that you read Slashdot, right?
Yeah, on occasion.
Well, have you read the article about the person that was detained had PGP encryption on his hard drive?
No. Detained where or by who?
At an airport, and he was suspected to have child pornography. And they accidentally turned his laptop off, and then he refused to give them the password, and the judge upheld him not having to give them their password.
No, I haven't heard about that. That's very interesting. How long ago?
A week or two ago. Yeah.
Okay, I was out of the country, so I should try to figure that out. Yeah. Okay, thank you. I'll try to dig that up. You don't remember a name or anything associated with it, or it was PGP specifically. Interesting. Okay, I'll try to track that down. That's a new development. Okay. You in the back, and then I'll get you.
For example, if you go to the Winnipeg Airport prior to come back to the United States, the U.S. Customs checkpoint is in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
When does the Fourth Amendment attach?
That's an interesting question. You are a U.S. person. You're a U.S. citizen, and the U.S. agent, the U.S. government is inspecting you. So I think that the Fourth Amendment, in my view, and again, this is an interesting question. I don't really know the answer to this question, okay? I don't think anyone really knows the answer, and it's debatable. But in my opinion, the Fourth Amendment applies to you because you are a U.S. person and you're dealing with the U.S. government. The question is, the problem is that it doesn't matter because all searches are reasonable because you're at the border. So, you know, it does you little good. But nevertheless, your Fourth Amendment. I think your rights are the same. But this is an interesting question because of Guantanamo Bay, and there was recently the Supreme Court handed down a decision quite recently, essentially upending this. But the reason that they put Guantanamo Bay in Guantanamo Bay instead of putting it in Florida was to create this jurisdictional arbitrage where they could say that they're not in the United States, and so the same rules of, you know, due process don't apply as they would if they were in the United States. And I think that the Supreme Court essentially said that the U.S. has been sovereign in control of Guantanamo Bay for 100 years, and so the rules are not different than they would be in Florida. That was the argument that was made for quite some time. So in general, that question is interesting. You next.
A couple of things. One, the whole get your data back off the cloud. I work for an advertising marketing firm.
Uh-huh.
Our average home directory size is about 150.
Oh, I know. It's very impractical.
As far as, after having spent about 7 years in the Air Force, in general, if you're on a U.S. military installation, that's considered U.S. soil.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of
the border up in Canada and the Bahamas or everywhere we have a pre-clearance port
yeah.
is considered the border.
Right.
The U.S. border, because you're basically you're going to go through customs in Winnipeg or wherever you're, and then you're going to get on a plane and actually come through. So it's called the functional equivalent of the border.
Yeah.
John McCain still being born on U.S. soil, even though he was born in Panama.
There's an interesting, she used the words functional equivalent of the border. There's an important sort of counter distinction there, I guess. You can be searched at the functional equivalent of the border. So that might be Winnipeg, and it may also be San Diego. Because they pull people over on the freeway between San Diego and Los Angeles. They have to know that the car crossed the border. They can't just do it at random. They have to know that the car crossed the border, the car came from Mexico. And so at that point, legally, the search happens under border search rules because it's considered to be the functional equivalent of the border, even though you're on the freeway north of San Diego in that context, because you have some reason that you have established that person crossed the border.
But that's why, like, if installations, even temporary ones in Saudi, you can still drink within the border. but that's I knew guys used to
do
all the time, and it'd be these little maybe 100-yard square radar installations, but inside that fence you could drink, and outside you were under sovereign laws, which meant you could.
I see. Yeah.
And the other thing is, for anyone talking about, like, I'm going to say no to the password, if you go to places like China or other places that don't have our laws.
Yeah.
There's a friend of mine.
Oh, you're right.
He had a great phrase. He called it rubber hose decryption.
Yeah. Yeah. No. You know, refusing your password to the U.S. government is one thing. Refusing it to the Chinese government is something else entirely.
If you go to France, it's illegal.
Yeah.
You just, you know, your plane stops over in France. You decide, hey, I'm going to go see Paris while I'm here. And you have an encrypted partition on your drive here in jail.
Yeah, and it's not just China. There's a lot of, you know, I had friends of mine who lived in Germany for many years, and they said, you don't flip off to the Polizei.
No, I mean, generally that's true. You don't talk shit to the cops, okay? If it turns out that the situation is bad, collect as much information as possible and talk to your lawyer about it later. You know, you don't want to get in an argument with someone who can make your life miserable. Anyway.
In response to that, I work for a French company, and I just got a laptop from them, and guess what? It's got true crypto on it.
Well, that's not right.
Are you trying to tell me that if I go over to France, where my parents come from, that I am just...
I don't know what the laws are in France.
Yes, no. See, it's really weird. We have a campus in France for Georgia Tech, and so it's really weird. We have to be very careful what we send over. If you're in France, you can use encryption. It's actually...
Oh, it's the importing of encryption software. That's right.
It's bad. So it's crossing the border with the encryption.
No, what I'm saying is I work here in the U.S. for a French company.
Yes, but see, that's the thing, is you have an entity already over there that you're working with that's part that is French, and so there's different rules for that.
They may have applied for a license for you to have it.
Yeah.
I know the other side of the equation. There are export laws which prohibit the export of cryptography from the United States, and there's a specific exemption for laptops so that you can have crypto on your laptop and you're not breaking the law if you leave the U.S. with the crypto software on your laptop. It's called the BAG exception. I don't know. I mean, it sounds like France does not have a similar import exemption, which is kind of stupid.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, they're trying to bust companies that are exporting or importing lots of cryptography or cryptography for commercial use. But yeah, I mean, you could befall this if you went in and they decided you were importing crypto on your laptop.
Regarding having the crypto on your laptop, does that just apply to the tools themselves? I mean, let's say that I have PGP encryption installed, but I don't actually have anything encrypted on it, or I'm not using anything with steganography or anything like that. I mean, like, just the presence of the tool itself.
I don't think the presence of the tool itself should create suspicion. You know, but I mean, it depends on the circumstances. Scott, am I like running way over? Do I need to? I got 5 minutes. Okay.
Yeah, a lot of these cases, we send people overseas all the time, and the issue is, do you want to be the test case?
Right.
Yeah, that's really I really don't want to be the test case. French jails suck.
would you know? No, I'm kidding.
No, actually, if you've seen the movie Catch Me If You Can?
Okay.
French jails suck. And they like it that they suck. So you really don't want to get caught there.
Right. Okay, thank you.
You want to challenge French law?
So I guess I should ask my IT department before I go fly over to France again, huh?
It's a valid question to ask.
Yeah. We have to go through Georgia Tech legal all the time. It's so convoluted we can't figure it out.
Two things. The case is U.S. versus Boucher, the PGP case.
Oh, okay. Boucher.
That was from 2007.
Boucher.
An appeal by now. I don't know what that is.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
The court appealed. The court held up the appeal and told the U.S. The TSA, I guess is what it is, they could not prosecute, or they could not detain or prosecute based off that period.
The TSA is totally different.
Yeah. I want to say, honestly, I don't think that had anything to do with the TSA. The Boucher case, I think, the Boucher case is the Fifth Amendment to reveal your password case.
Right.
Yeah, okay. I think he might be talking about something different.
Okay, there was another one.
It was recent on Firetalk, so.
I'll figure it out. What was your other fifth?
There. And I'm not saying this is the answer, but plausible deniability is the way to go. And I would dare you to find a second encrypted partition using TrueCrypt, using that method. Basically, a partition within a partition that can't be seen.
Somebody's.
Well, no, what I can tell you're running TrueCrypt, and then I can interrogate you. I can't find it.
But I can log you in. You can boot my laptop up, and I'll let you log in. I'll give you my TrueCrypt password.
Uh-huh.
And you can boot any of multiple OSs.
Right, right. And so the question is, am I satisfied that you've shown me everything?
Correct.
Right.
If you're a U.S. citizen, whether you were born here or you come from an African, which probably not.
Okay.
Not at all. I would like to say real quick is write to Congress. Think about it. Write to them. Write to your congressman. We're law enforcement officers. We enforce the law. If they change the law, we'll enforce a different one. I might not agree with half the law.
Don't make Tammy's life difficult because you're pissed off at U.S. policy. She can't change it. She just works here.
Yep. But I can't cherry pick the ones that, or if I do, then I'm probably going to jail. But the reasonable suspicion thing, if they're going to change that defines not just for laptops, but that defines our entire job. Going through anything, cargo, your clothing, keeping you in a hospital, whatever. So if they are going to change what reasonable suspicion and define what it means and be more specific with it, they're going to change what our entire job encompasses. And so, I don't care either way, but I'm just saying it's probably going to be a long time coming because they will have to redefine what customs reassess that whole thing.
I think that all that's on the table really, and in my view, all that's on the table is just whether or not reasonable suspicion is required to search a laptop, as opposed to necessarily attempting to define what reasonable suspicion is in some more specific way than it already is defined.
I guess part of the problem would be, why would a laptop be, other than, there's stuff on there, other than luggage that is packed, not packed, and all that stuff, but a laptop by law would have to be different from everything else.
That's true. That's true.
I mean, it's interesting to me because it involves what I do.
I mean, so I try in this presentation to present my talking points about that, but I really think that a laptop contains a huge amount of personal information, and so it is fundamentally different from what you guys usually deal with. It's not a piece of luggage, wherein that luggage only contains what I meant to pack for travel. There could be personal items here and there in my luggage that I don't want to expose, but a laptop is like a it's where all of the really private stuff goes, and it's got it all. It's not just got a little bit of it, and so it crosses this threshold. One of the arguments that has been made by this guy, who is I think his last name is Roush. He's like a former DOJ prosecutor. His view was that customs should be able to boot the laptop and look at like the desktop and just kind of give it a cursory look without reasonable suspicion, but actually going through and reading email or doing a detailed forensic analysis, like that's where he felt like the line should be drawn. So some analysis of the laptop should be possible randomly, but deep analysis of the laptop should require reasonable suspicion.
From our perspective, it's a matter of time. We don't have time to search 10,000.
That's true. That's true.
If I'm asking questions, I turn your computer and you sound legit and I don't find anything. You know, don't be surprised. I'm not going to sit there, because I mean, part of it's because I know shit about anything. But but if I'm talking to you and it sounds weird, we are going to hold it. But from a time perspective and our resources, I'd rather spend 10 minutes on someone who I know is weird than grab 10 random people.
I agree, but one of the things that I'm Chertoff did essentially come out and say that basically what you just said. There's a question about people could if the policy would allow customs to do it at random, and so customs could decide to do it at random. The other thing is that if the hard drive duplication technology improved substantially, you look at it on a 40-year time horizon, you could end up in a situation where it's possible to duplicate everyone's hard drive instantly, and you don't do the analysis. You just duplicate the hard drives, and there's some automated technology doing analysis, and so it becomes a totally different thing. And I don't know, whatever. That's it. I think we're way over time. How are you, Scott? Do you want us to stop?
Yeah, we need to wrap it up.
Okay. Well, thank you, everyone, for your time. If you're concerned about this, here's the URL, and thanks for your time.